oldest customers have been with us from the get-go, so about 13, 14 years now. We still have quite a few of those. The cycle would really depend on the type of client. So we've only talked about investment properties so far, but we do everything. So we're trying, we have positioned ourselves as the Japan real estate contact in English. So people approach us about everything. There are some things that we have to refuse, but most of it we will try to do. So investors are different from holiday home shoppers, are different from people who buy land for land banking. And within the investor sphere, I mean, we sometimes get somebody who, you know, their entire life savings is $50,000. They want to invest it in something related to real estate in Japan. And then they'll, you know, maybe in 6, 7, 8 years' time, they'll save another $50,000. But the other section of our investor pool is usually people who have more funds available. So they would first test us with one or two cheaper properties, and then they'd come back a year or two later and say, okay, now let's invest the rest. And then they'll buy something bigger or a lot more properties. So it really varies by investor type or by client type of investor. Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over 2 decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right. So before we go any further, you have now got exactly 3 days. That's right. 3 days as of the publishing of this episode is when the early bird discount for tickets to the Japan Real Estate Summit ends. The summit is taking place Saturday and Sunday, 18th and 19th April at the fabulous Hotel Pullman in Tamachi, Tokyo. And online, of course, via the stream, which is the next best thing to being there in person. You'll be able to network with everyone else in the streaming room, as well as float questions to our speakers to be answered live on stage. Speaking of speakers and sponsors, we have a phenomenal gallery of those for you this time around. Blanca Kobayashi from Arc Reform, Emil Gorgis from realestate.jp, Tracy Northcott from Tokyo Family Stays, Alicia Kin Wang from Axolotl Capital, Mark Drabkin from Yen Loans, Chai Kanda, Yi Zhang and Ben from Shiki Properties, Shumatsuo Post and Brett Lee from Akiahub, John Cross from MailMate, Robert from Innovatius.com, Ben Tanaka from Retired Japan, Matt Ketchum from Akias, Tatemono IQ and Assist, and of course myself, Ziv Nakajima again from Nippon Trading's International, NTI, hopefully you know who I am by now. We are all waiting to meet you face-to-face or online via the stream. And most importantly, so are the rest of our community. All of you Japan real estate property enthusiasts and professionals, many of whom have been coming back time after time, twice a year, for Japan's biggest English language industry event. So tickets, again, are only discounted until the 28th of February, which is, again, in 3 days as of the publishing of this episode. So, yeah, if you know you'll be attending in person or online, pause the episode now. Hop over to summit.realestate.jp, grab your tickets today while they're still heavily discounted, although they will be very fairly priced after the deadline as well. All right, so for today's episode, this one was actually recorded right before our previous summit when I was in Tokyo back in October, and this is an interview that I gave to Jeremy Lovelin, VP of Sales at Momentum Worldwide Movers. They're a great shipping and moving company who assist companies and individuals relocating or relocating their staffers, as the case may be, into and out of Japan. Jeremy's a friend and a colleague, but more importantly, he's got a really good podcast and YouTube channel where he interviews various business owners based in or doing business in Japan, and we'll link to it in this episode show notes, of course. And Jeremy wanted to pick my brain about, well, about everything, really. My personal story, how I ended up doing what I do here in Japan. He wanted to know why people purchase property here in the first place, how our property purchase and management services work, why they're even needed, what it's like working with Japanese property professionals. And that led us to dig into Japanese versus Western mentality a little bit, especially when it comes to work-life balance, personal boundaries, client relationships, and so forth. We dug into how we staff and run our business, the cultural gap, and the interesting lost in translation moments that I've experienced personally over the years, and all of the other cultural issues, not to say minefields, that we have to navigate on a daily basis, the intricacies of doing business in Japan, the distribution of work between myself and my partners, the very niche but fascinating ecosystem of bilingual, foreigner-friendly realtors that we work with here. Akia, the unique issues that come with Akia, included but not limited to dealing with Akia banks, Minpaku Airbnb properties, how to run those the right way, how to buy in rural areas, and how to deal with Japanese rural communities. We also talked about how to target and buy the right property that might actually work for a hospitality business. And we also talked a little bit about Nippon Bridge, my other company, the one that handles business investments and relocation support services, which is really where we and Momentum Worldwide movers paths cross. So what do we do? How can we support their clients and potential clients? And speaking of clients, how do we market and acquire new clients? Lastly, we talked about Japan's attitude towards foreigners, past, present, and future. And finally, a bit about my own personal plans for the future, as well as my personal life philosophy. You might want to check out at that stage of the conversation. And of course, we couldn't finish the conversation without chatting a bit about Fukuoka City. Hands down, best city in Japan. You must have heard me say this before here on the podcast if you're a listener, at least in my opinion, and how Fukuoka compares to Tokyo, to Osaka, and to other parts of the country. So a bit of a more personal conversation this time around, but hopefully with quite a lot of content that you may found value in. Hope you enjoy it.
My name is Jeremy Lachlan, and this podcast is brought to you by my company, Momentum Worldwide Movers. We focus on providing tailor-made solutions to match the specific requirements of each customer, since every move is unique. Ziv Nakajima Magen is a Japanese-based entrepreneur and cross-border consultant with extensive experience in real estate, business setup, and international investment. As co-founder and COO of the companies Nippon Tradings International and Nippon Bridge, he helps individuals and companies purchase, sell, and manage their Japanese real estate portfolios, establish businesses, relocate, and invest in Japan, while bringing opportunities between Japan and global markets. With a background in project management, advisory service, and international networking, Ziv combines practical expertise with cultural fluency to support clients in navigating Japan's unique business and lifestyle environment. All right, Ziv, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I see that it's a trend with most of my guests that they started off their careers doing something completely different to what they're doing now. And it seems like that applies to you as well. So you started your career doing some pretty heavy-duty IT stuff, correct?
Yes, that's right. I was born and bred in Israel, and I the first, I guess, decade of my career was in IT. When I moved to Australia as well, I continued with IT.
Okay, but eventually you got into real estate, and when you came to Japan, the focus of your career has been on real estate, right?
Yes, that's correct. Or it started that way. These days, I've branched off into some other stuff, but yes.
Just to confirm, in Australia, you were doing some real estate as well, or was that mostly IT focused?
Not doing work-wise. What happened was that I've inherited a property in Australia from an elderly granduncle who passed away. So I guess you could call me an accidental landlord. So I had a little bit of experience managing a property and then
purchasing and selling, not really purchasing, but selling it down the track. So when I wanted to do, to invest in something and to do some sort of financial related work in Japan, real estate was just the only experience I had at that point in time.
Okay. So what was the catalyst for real estate? What was the main thing? It's just something that you were interested in?
Well, I was in a position where I wanted to get a financial foothold in Japan, and I had some funds to invest. It's just that real estate was the only thing that I kind of knew investment-wise at the time, so it was just a natural progression for me.
Okay. So instead of doing corporate real estate, or working for a big company, I should say, you started your own company. So why did you take that route?
That fork in the road I passed a few years prior to that in Australia. When my wife at the time got pregnant, we both recognized that we want to spend more time together. And we figured out that once we have a child, then we'll definitely want to spend more time together. So I started exploring routes of self-employment, I guess you could call it. I started out contracting to some companies in the beginning, so I had more flexible hours. And then eventually down the track, we wanted to work together. So we set up a company and a business that enabled us to continue to work together. So by the time we weren't together, unfortunately, she passed away. By the time we weren't together anymore, I knew that especially now that I was what I thought at the time would be a single parent, there was no way I was going back to being employed. I was going to do my own thing. So that was never even an option when I thought about real estate.
Okay. So the name of your company is Nippon Tradings International. Can you tell me more about the name? Because when you hear about a trading company, you think of the traditional shosha, right? But that's not what your company is it?
Yeah. It's not. But when we set it up, we had the idea that we might branch into other things as well. So we didn't want the name to be tied directly into real estate. We haven't given it that much thought at the time, but we wanted something that would be wide enough or vague enough to enable us to do other things down the track if we wanted to as well, and also that would have, you know, some sort of a catchy abbreviation. So it just worked out, and, you know, we seem to like it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How long have you been running the company now? For many years, right?
14 years now.
14 years, yeah. And can you tell us a little bit more about what you do? Because you're involved in investment management, right?
On the real estate front, that's how we started out, yeah.
For real estate. So I'm curious to know more about your demographic. Because in Japan, you know, investing in real estate, it's not commonly known as something that's so lucrative, right? Or like the capital gains that you get, the capital appreciation, right, is not really, like, you know, considerable, right?
Through that prism, I guess, yes, you could call it not profitable, but Japan, for one, is a very different market in many aspects, but also from what makes it profitable or what makes it attractive front. But also, I would argue that in other places in the world, that paradigm of every 7 years real estate goes up, that doesn't really hold as steady as it used to. So the way it works in Japan is people come here for a bunch of reasons. They're either Japanophiles to one level or another. They've been here, they like the country, they want to put some money into the country one way or the other. But what attracts other people that are not even necessarily that familiar with Japan is, number one, the stability of the income. So you're dealing with Japanese tenants who tend to stay in place a lot longer than tenants in other countries. The rental yields, compared to other countries, not as attractive now as it was when we started 14 years ago, but still, compared to other developed countries, it's good enough. It's, you know, 5-6% in rental yield before tax, if you buy the right things. And it also comes with far less hassles and headaches than properties in other countries. You don't have to get particularly creative, do flips, do very, you know, creative sort of deals. The money is in the bank every month. It's like a kind of a mini salary that you get. And that's what tends to draw people here usually.
So it's more of a sustainable investment.
Yes, it's cash flow oriented. It's not, I mean, mm-hmm. capital appreciation has been happening here over the last 15 years, but I wouldn't bet on it to continue considering Japan's demographics and its shrinking workforce and the debt to GDP ratio and all of the other macroeconomic and macro geopolitical factors that are surrounding us. That's not something that I would speculate on necessarily continuing or not. So the cash flow, the monthly stability of it and the lack of headaches and the affordability in lots of parts of the country, it's still very, very cheap to buy, which means that you can diversify. Like if you would have put the same capital into a single asset in another country, here you can buy maybe four or five of these assets and all of them are generating income. So it gives you socioeconomic diversity. It gives you geographical diversity. One tenant moves out, that's, you know, 20% of your income stream gone, not the entire thing. There are other advantages to investing here.
Okay. So I would imagine that you have quite a lot of competition out there in your industry.
Funnily enough, not that much. The only thing that would potentially, I would maybe classify as competition is good foreigner-friendly bilingual real estate agents, which we're not. We're not agents. We're never positioned ourselves to be brokers or agents from the get-go. And they need as much help as our clients do in bridging the gap. So even if they worked with foreigners in the past, there are still so many idiosyncrasies and nuances that need smoothing out or flattening out. There's more professional, like agents, even if they do work regularly with non-resident, non-Japanese clients, they would do a fantastic job. They're being Japanese. They normally do a fantastic job. They're very professional. They dot all the I's and cross all the T's, but they're not very proactive by nature, I guess, of being Japanese. They're not super proactive and they're not super strategic. So they perceive their role as to make sure that transaction goes through smoothly and legally. They don't often offer the due diligence, support, or the strategic thinking that our clients tend to need coming into Japan, not knowing anything about the market here. And the agents would be like, you know, they'd help research listings, or the client would provide listings and they say, which one would you like to apply for? That's where the conversation usually ends with them. If they're asked questions, they'll definitely answer them truthfully, but the people don't know what questions to ask. They've never bought here before. So I don't see anyone. I see some people providing similar services, but they tend to focus on high-end only, maybe because they have expensive Tokyo offices, or maybe, I don't know, they're the types that don't get out of bed for less than that. But somebody who covers the entire country at the level of strategic advice that we provide at any price level, I do not see that much competition in the market now.
So you're basically a consultancy at the end of the day then?
That's half of it. The other half of it is providing proxy services. So people who don't reside, our Japanese resident clients don't need that, but people who don't reside here, don't have an address certificate, can't open a bank account, can't come here in person as many times as required to sign stuff and do stuff during the purchase and the management process. And they need somebody here to represent them. Even more so when it comes to management, if it's an investment property, then you would need somebody to deal with the property manager. Most property managers in Japan would not be able to wrap their heads around the concept of dealing with a non-resident, non-Japanese-speaking client. So somebody needs to be in between. Building management companies, owner unions, insurance companies, the tax department in most of Japan, just somebody needs to be here physically on the ground.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Given the challenges in Japanese real estate or finding housing in Japan, et cetera. I've been here for a long time too, so I know. I would imagine that your work keeps you extremely busy. Like,
disgusting.
When do you take a holiday? Yeah.
That goes into personal character, I think. So my wife and partner, Chikako-san, for example, is very not run-of-the-mill in all aspects, but in that aspect of Japanese mentality, she just doesn't take holidays. For her, a holiday means complete disconnection for, you know, a week or two or three. And it means that there is nothing waiting for me to be done at the office before I can even walk out the door. So she just does not take holidays. I think she'll eventually burn out. I keep telling her that, but she doesn't. For me, it's more, I guess maybe it's more of a Western approach, but for me, it's more about setting boundaries, right? So there's always going to be stuff waiting for me to act on. I personally don't mind working until 9, 10, 11, midnight any day, and then I will enshrine the weekend, right? So nobody talks to me from Friday evening until Monday morning. Chikako can talk to me, but I mean, no customers can send me messages. If it's super urgent, I might take some action on it, or I might just reply that I'll get back to you Monday. If I do any kind of work on the weekend, it's not going to be with people. It's going to be me wanting to do something that I've put out, and it, you know, it feels comfortable for me to do it, but I'm going to make sure that I have my downtime. Similarly, when I go on holiday, I dedicate half the day to work, and then half the day I just enjoy the holiday, which gives me the flexibility to be able to pretty much take it, barring events like we've got coming up now, gives me the opportunity to just take a holiday whenever I want and almost as long as I want, really.
Right. So you have a little bit of flexibility.
I have a lot of flexibility, but I mean, the customer becomes the boss, right? Like anybody who owns a business.
Right. Which leads me to my next question, which is, are most of your relationships more transactional or are they ongoing, right? Because at the surface, it sounds like it's more of a just, you know, you get the work done that, and then they're off on their own, right? Do they ever come back to you and, you know, because maybe they're having difficulties with the property managers or, you know?
Well, again, 80 or so percent of our clients don't reside in Japan. So somebody will need to manage the property for them. Usually it is going to be us. So the relationship, definitely, I'd say 80% of it continues far beyond settlement. We're the ones who are going to be on the hook for management. I mean, yes, we're working with third parties, but if anything goes wrong, we're the ones who need to take action. If a property manager doesn't do their job properly, we're the ones who need to replace them. If the property doesn't perform as we expected for whatever reason, then we're the ones who need to make sure that we resell it and get, you know, as close to possible to market to whatever they purchased it for, etc. So the relationship definitely continues in the vast majority of cases.
Okay. And what would be like the typical cycle, customer cycle for you? I guess it depends, right? But it could last up to years. Or
our oldest customers have been with us from the get-go, so about 13, 14 years now. We still have quite a few of those. The cycle would really depend on the type of client. So we've only talked about investment properties so far, but we do everything. So we have positioned ourselves as the Japan real estate contact in English. So people approach us about everything. There are some things that we have to refuse, but most of it we will try to do. So investors are different from holiday home shoppers, are different from people who buy land for land banking. And within the investor sphere, I mean, we sometimes get somebody who, you know, their entire life savings is $50,000. They want to invest it in something related to real estate in Japan. And then they'll, you know, maybe in 6, 7, 8 years time, they'll save another $50,000. But the other section of our investor pool is usually people who have more funds available. So they would first test us with one or two cheaper properties, and then they'd come back a year or two later and say, okay, now let's invest the rest, and then they'll buy something bigger or a lot more properties. So it really varies by investor type or by client type if they're not investors.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in WebDiz Solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company, Innovatius, is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Mm-hmm. So you must hire a lot of customer service reps then.
When we're fully staffed at NTI, the real estate company, when we're fully staffed, we're a team of 10, including Chikako and myself.
Yeah. So that still sounds low to me though, because
we're a small company.
There's a clear distinction between like what our company does and what you do, because, you know, we help people move things abroad, right? So we help people move their goods from destination A to B. And, you know, within that period, I mean, there's going to be a lot of client concerns and us, you know, handling inquiries and things like that and managing it. Mm. But once the move is done, you know, they're gone, right? It's sayonara, you know. Yeah. And of course I like to keep in touch with people, and some people might move back to Japan. Mm. But basically the job is done, right? But in your case, I mean, you know, you just mentioned 13 years, right? You know, with us, the relocation might happen, you know, it might take, if they're moving from Japan to the UK, it might take about 3 months, right? Mm-hmm. If it's a sea shipment, you know, but that's not that long of a time, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, we might put one or two people on it to kind of manage, right? But for you, I mean, you must have all kinds of inquiries. So that's why I'm kind of surprised that the...
Well, but bear in mind,
you can do it with a small team. Yeah.
Well, from our perspective, it's not that small, right? We started with just ourselves and added one more, et cetera. But bear in mind that everything... So yes, we're the single point of contact for the client, but everything that we do is outsourced. We're not the property managers. We're not the renovation company. We're not the real estate agent. We're definitely not the legal representation, and we're not the insurers, right? So we do everything through third parties, which means that boots on the ground, they do the work. Our job is more the communication and data management, financial reporting, and so forth, which we're also stuffing up because we're having growing pains. So that's always a process. But the way it works with us is we've got one staffer who's in charge of holiday homes management, one staffer, and a lot of that is going now to my other company, by the way, because NTI wants to focus more on investments. We love that we're the single point of contact, but there are processes that just make it easier for us to focus on investment. So we got one who's managing holiday home, one who's managing investment properties, one back office processes and documentation and data, two bookkeepers. And then on the sales and marketing front, not that many. We've got one social media person and one, initial inquiry or client management person who just receives everything and then distributes it internally where it needs to go.
Okay. So when I did my research, I noticed that it seems like you have a lot of sales and marketing people who are not Japanese. Right. Who've been
not a lot for sure, but okay. I'm glad it looks that way.
It looks that way on online, right?
Yeah. And
within your marketing presence. Mm. But then I noticed that you have people on the back end who are Japanese.
Yes, correct.
And And I'm pretty sure that that's not a coincidence, right?
No.
You have the tax people or visa people or finance people. Mm. They're all Japanese. That's what
yes,
I noticed.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. 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 And they all need to be everyone in the company needs to be bilingual to some extent, except maybe my personal admin, who is not like an employee of the company because she does a lot of stuff for me, but she's the only one who probably really needs, really heavily relies on translation tools if she needs to parse anything in Japanese. But everybody else has to be bilingual. The marketing and sales side of the business has to be native English speaking. So when we post anything online, when we put listings, when we answer customer inquiries, we can't afford these little lost in translation errors, which again is a large part of why the Japanese side actually needs someone like us. On the back end, Japan being Japan, with the mountains of paperwork and everything having to be done in Japanese and with proper Keigo Japanese and all the right kanjis and legal documents and so forth, naturally they have to be native Japanese speakers, yes.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Now, can you tell me about some of the challenges that you have, guiding foreigners in Japan? I remember a couple of weeks ago on LinkedIn, you shared a post, and it was like some
that went viral.
Some AI of a foreign businessman and a Japanese businessman, and they weren't getting on very well.
Correct.
Now, did something happen that kind of provoked you to do that?
I don't like the word provoke. Prompted.
Okay. We'll stay positive.
And then I'm joking. I like to be provoked. I like online debates. I jump in there happily if I know what I'm talking about. Otherwise, I'll shut up and learn. But there was a particular case that triggered it, but I then constructed the post in a way that just brought together a lot of stuff that I've gone through over the years. What happened in that particular case is I was inquiring with a certain real estate agent that we haven't worked with before. He quoted a customer on going out to a viewing trip, and he mentioned something about two people needing to go on the trip. Cost-wise, it wasn't a big deal. They priced it so that it wasn't prohibitive at all. But I was just wondering, and I asked him in private. It wasn't even in a public chat or correspondence. But I asked him, why do you need to send two people? Because all of the other agents that we work with just either go by themselves or they send a person from their office. Why do you need two people? I'm not sure which toe I stepped on in that case, but that turned into an explosion that almost destroyed the relationship before it even began. So I had to quickly jump in and clarify again that I'm not asking this to be confrontational. I'm asking because I'm trying to understand why do you need two people on the job so that I can explain it to the next customer, right? That's the reason for the question. And that relationship, thankfully, was saved for now at least. But it just brought to mind a lot of other things and other relationships that didn't even get to that point of where I had the chance to amend things because somebody bristled up and walked away with big drama in one way or another. So that's one thing that happens with particular Japanese companies and Japanese professionals. But that's not really when it does happen, that usually brings up either red flags, meaning maybe you don't want to work with that company because maybe they're putting on that show to obscure something that they just don't want to talk about. Or in other cases, maybe they're just not experienced. Like they want to work with foreigners. They're taking their first step and then they get hit in the face with all of these cultural differences and people asking questions that they don't normally ask in Japan in ways that we don't normally ask them in Japan. And maybe they don't want to work with foreigners after that experience. So that's not necessarily reflecting badly on them. It's just maybe they thought they could and they couldn't.
Right. So how do you maintain your relationships then? I mean, is there a small number of firms that you work with? Or
so it depends on what we're doing. There's two ways in which we work. One is complete facilitation, meaning with a single point of contact, the client gives us authority to act on their behalf in Japan. We attend all the meetings. We talk to the agents. They need to do nothing except maybe have a couple of documents signed and witnessed at the start and then a couple more at the end, right? if we're doing it that way, then Chikako manages the relationship. She works with native Japanese agents. We do all of the facilitation, translation. We provide versions of the documents in English for clients to view. And then she would normally, alerts go up much earlier in the process. So she would, you know, if we contact a listing agent for the first time and there's something a bit sus in the way that they reply or they, you know, feature dramatic tendencies from the get-go, and then she would quickly sever that relationship and we'll move on to them. That's not an issue because there are thousands and thousands of real estate agents in Japan who are native Japanese. As long as we don't need the bilingual or non-resident aspect of it, then everything's fine and we can always find another one. The other way that we work is a consulting method in which we put the client directly in touch with a foreigner-friendly English or bilingual-speaking Japanese realtor that we've worked with before and vetted. So there's always going to be the first time when we haven't worked with them before. But I'm always happy to onboard more and more of these because there's not many of them. And then in that case, we will be joining the correspondents as consultants, not as proxies. They'll be working directly in front of the agent, the judicial scrivener, the lawyer. And we will be on the sidelines guiding due diligence and advising. Those kinds of agents are very rare in Japan. There's more of them now. There were nearly none of them when we started. Now there's more of them, mostly in Tokyo still, but you know, flexible enough so that they're willing to travel all over the country and do work all over the country if they're getting paid for their time. Those agents are worth their weight in gold. So I will always do my best to keep that relationship alive, unless, again, they've done something or exhibited something that just makes it impossible to work with them.
Right. So what do you think about the market then? Is the market still hot right now? I mean, is it hotter than ever? Because if you have these type of companies springing up, it would suggest that this is a good time to invest.
The market is very hot in top tier cities, central. I mean, you can see by the prices. Well, what's happening in Tokyo, Fukuoka, which is now at Osaka levels, and or central Osaka, which is almost at Tokyo levels. And Tokyo's gone way past its 90s bubble peak, right? So we've gone all the way down, then all the way up, and then some. The market is hot. The Akiya market is also very hot because of all of the international media attention to the $1 houses in the Japanese countryside, which we can talk about that later. But I think what it is the agents that I'm seeing tend to be younger in the vast majority of cases, or at least the ones that we end up continuously working with, the ones that are more flexible in their thinking tend to be a lot younger. And I think there's a shift in Japan from, number one, from the lifetime salaryman contract, right? There's a lot of young people setting up companies, right? Some of them are doing startups in various fields. Some of them have worked in real estate for many years or for a few years even, and then they feel like they're actually, why shouldn't I open my own company? And why shouldn't I? I mean, I'm bilingual. I'm the only one in my company. They don't always appreciate me as much as they should. So why not do it by myself? And these are the people that we usually end up working with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people that have some deep experience, right? People who are not just, you know, riding the wave, right?
We do have some less experienced young folks. They would normally not necessarily have the real estate license, but they team up with a more traditional Japanese agent who handles the official signings and the legal side of things. And then they would be working with that agent. Either they set up their own company or they just partner up, and they then provide these services directly to the customer and get the Japanese official guy to do the signing and so forth, the taken. But in all of these cases, even if they are more experienced, there's still that mentality. So even if they have the information in their head and they can advise the client, a lot of them will not, it just doesn't come to them to speak up before the clients ask them a question. So all of that information needs to be sometimes dragged out of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
Well, let's move on to the Akiya discussion. And this is something that you're also involved in, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it seems like a whole different ballgame.
Holiday homes generally tend to be a different ballgame. They come in all shapes and forms. I mean, I was saying in an interview the other day that Akiya, like, we helped a customer recently buy a million-dollar home in central Kyoto that wasn't lived in for 2 years. So that's also an Akiya, right? Mm-hmm. The people who approach that kind of purchase are very different from the people who are looking for $20,000 out in the countryside, which is what international media usually refers to as Akiya.
Right. The usual expectation is you're going to find something cheap.
Yep.
Right.
Dilapidated old ghost house in the countryside. Yeah.
But I'm amazed that this is allowed in Japan.
How do
you know? Well, I mean, you know, because of after living here for a long time and just knowing, you know, the reservations, you know, Japanese would have with non-Japanese you know, using the house, especially for not as a holiday home, but as a B&B, right? Mm. You know, and just, you know, crashing the neighborhood, right?
That's the bad way of running a hospitality property. There is a right way to do it, which involves the community and the neighborhood. I'm not the expert. There's people who speak a lot more about that in our other events, but when it's done properly, hospitality properties rejuvenate neighborhoods, right? They take little dying towns that are, you know, if the municipality and the neighbors see eye to eye, and if the people who are buying these houses and running these operations are doing it in conjunction with them, then that's a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, not everybody does that. But I think it's like the Akiya banks, right? So the local, there's always that huge gap in Japan between what the official government policy is and what happens boots on the ground. So the government has already seen years and years ago that Akiyas are a problem. So the official policy from the government to all of these local municipalities, hey, set up an Akiya bank. Let's pull up all of these properties that you've got lying around rotting in town and let's start selling them. And then it really depends, because there's never any enforcement. So then it really depends on what the local municipality does. Some of them are all gung-ho into the project and they actually make it work. And then those towns become beautiful and, you know, touristic, and people come over and people set up proper operations. Some of them just go, okay, well, we have to have an Akiya. Tanaka-san, you're the Akiya Bank. And then there's somebody there who is like officially the person, but they're not doing anything about it. And when you contact them, you get the usual teeth sucking in. Ah, no, actually, oh, foreigner, I don't know. We need to check. Maybe not. They never get back to you. They just put lots of hurdles in your way. They try to persuade you not to buy there. Other places they are getting into it and they're happy to try the rejuvenation, but they put all of these restrictions on it, which just don't, they're just scared of opening it too wide. So they don't allow short-term stays in certain days or certain weeks. They want only people who are moving into and living in the community. So not holiday homemakers. Those are kind of in between. It really depends on how it's done. We try to educate our clients on what's the proper way to do things. Get to know your neighbors, be a part of the community, knock on doors, explain what you're going to be doing here, and make sure that you're following, obviously, all the regulations to the letter, and make sure that your guests are aware of what's allowed and not allowed and how to be, you know, in line with neighborhood requirements and so forth. And then it turns out well. But in many cases, we just unfortunately tell them that it's not a good idea.
Right. So I think that the community approach sounds more logical than the private approach.
In Japan, absolutely.
Yeah. Because, you know, your neighbors in Japan are not like your neighbors in Western countries, right? Mm. Or in other countries, right?
It's a mentality thing, right? Like, I remember, because again, we participate in online discussions in various groups and forums, social media and whatnot. And there was just one conversation I remember specifically where somebody just couldn't wrap their head around, why do I need to talk to the neighbors? It's legal. I'm allowed to do what I want here. I have the license to do this. Why should I?
It's very much a mentality, but it's a cultural mentality in Japan, right? And it's kind of considered taboo to like mess with you, like to, you know, try to convince your neighbors to do something or to something that's good. I mean, or to build like a real relationship with your neighbors, right?
Not in the countryside. Countryside, the neighbors will be in your face whether you want them to or not. I mean, yes, there are always hikikomoris or there are always people who just don't like foreigners and don't talk to you. But there are so many friendly obachan who will share vegetables with you and invite you to the neighborhood barbecue and so forth.
But, you know, sharing vegetables is one thing, but, you know, making investments is another thing, right? Or let me give you an example, okay, though, of where I'm coming from. So I am looking at a country home, right? I'm looking to invest in a country home, right, in Japan. You know, maybe not immediately, but this is definitely something I want to do because I'm here for the long run.
Invest, you mean hospitality property in the countryside?
I don't know if I'm going to turn it into a B&B.
Okay.
It would probably be, you know, 80% or basically for my own use, right, as a country home. You know, if it was logical, if it made sense to do it to rent it out to, tourists or whatever, then I would do that. But I would have to take some time to, you know, carefully think about that. So we found a nice place. I'm not gonna name the exact place, but let's just say in the western mountains of Tokyo.
Okay.
Okay.
When you say country, you're still within an hour from Tokyo.
About 2 hours, but you're basically in the hills.
Right. Got it.
Right. And a little old house, but a very with a beautiful garden, a Japanese style house, and with a real kotatsu, and with just the design and everything was great, and there was like a old style hibachi thing, a fire pit and everything.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
I love those.
People who are into Japan, historical Japan, would just love it. You know, have a tea. You're in the hills, you know. It's a bit of an old place, but just a beautiful, beautiful garden. And we were lucky enough that the owners were there because they're trying to sell it. But they were there just for cleaning, and we wanted to check out the area, but we didn't expect the owners to be there. But they happened to be there, and so they showed us the place. But the neighbors were there too, and they were nice, and they did, you know, konnichiwa and everything. Mm. But the place was, their yard was just a mess. I mean, there was crap all over the place.
Yeah.
And there was like a rice cooker was kind of up in the tree or something like that. I've never seen anything like that in Japan, actually. I mean, I know Japan has ghettos, but this was
a Texas chainsaw.
It was like a
backyard.
It was a beautiful, nice little house, and next to it was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre yeah. house of Japan. And then, you know, after we looked at the place, we just said no, you know. I mean, my wife was like, yeah, no. And I'm like, right. Well, you know, if you know, we invest in a place and I'm out there, I can maybe say, you know, talk to them and say, you know, hey, you know, clean it up. And she's like, yeah, that's not what we do in Japan.
That doesn't
fly here. And I just gave up. So, yeah.
That is a bit of a unique case, though. Like, most of them.
I'm sorry for rambling on my own podcast.
No. But, it's very interesting, yeah, actually. Yeah. We run across these kinds of houses and neighbors, or neighbors who are just not friendly, right? Which is the other thing. Like, either it's not friendly on the eye, or it's just not friendly socially. But that's a pretty rare case. In most cases, what you'll hopefully get is something which is at least has a little bit, if you're really talking countryside, you might have a bit of more of a distance to the neighbors, or the neighbors, I mean, let's put it this way. If the neighborhood looks like a full-on residential neighborhood, I would probably avoid it. You want to see at least a few shops, restaurants, like public conveniences, except a convenience store, I mean, in the immediate area to kind of have, because if you're going to be moving into a strictly residential neighborhood, whether it's upmarket or lower, you're going to be the only one in that area doing anything like rentals, right? So in those cases, I'd probably advise to use your own channels, you know, work with friends and family who want to take a holiday in the countryside. Maybe they refer somebody to you, and then, you know, they kind of officially pay you for participation in the utilities. It's not a real rental. If you want to get a license and you want to have and you really want to rent out the place short-term stay or medium-term, even if it's for like a month at a time, it depends on whether you want it profitable or not. If you want to buy a place and it's, like you said, 80% going to be a holiday home, and then see what I can do with it when I'm not using it, that's one story. But if from the get-go this is to be an investment, like you mentioned, and you're wanting it to at least cover its costs and hopefully then some, I would do a bit more planning than that. I would look at neighborhoods which are not strictly residential. If it's out in the sticks in Inaka property, I'd make sure I have enough of a space where, you know, ugly stuff like that is not an issue for the guests. And then your marketing would have to reflect that. Then it becomes a bit of a job, right? Because you have to sell. If you bought a cheap property in a cheap area, it probably means the area is not super popular with tourists as well. Otherwise, it wouldn't be cheap, right? So then you have to market the whole area, the experience. You're not just marketing your house, which might look beautiful on the inside, but then what do they do when they step out, right? So it's a lot of work to run a profitable short-term stay business, which is why we personally have never gotten into it and probably never will. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of planning. And if you want it to be profitable, then you have to kind of level up. It's not a full-time job, but it's very hands-on.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And I'm sure we can keep talking about this. But let's move on and let's talk about some of the other stuff that you're involved in. So other than the real estate side of things, you focus on some relocation services as well.
Yes. So my other company that I've set up almost 4 years ago now is focused on, firstly, investment facilitation, which is not real estate. So people who want to invest in Japan, but for one reason or another, either because they want higher yield or because they want to leverage that for a visa, it makes more sense to invest in something that's not real estate. So we help them with that. We represent them as franchisees joining franchise chains in Japan, or M&A-ing existing businesses, buying businesses that want to, you know, that have succession issues, or just businesses that for one reason or another are for sale, or setting up their own business. And then a lot of them also need our help with relocation. So if they have invested in whatever kind of business for the visa, eventually they will get the visa, whether we refer them to an immigration lawyer or they have their own. And then when they move to Japan, they'll need a lot of help. Sometimes with the business to open a bank account, they'll need us to appoint ourselves as interim representative directors, which works a lot better with Japanese banks and whatnot. So all kinds of services related to people relocating to Japan on a business level and then on a personal level. So we refer them to Momentum, for example, for shipping and so forth. Then when the stuff is here, we work with local moving companies if we need to. We connect them to utilities, register the kids for school, register a car to drive in Japan, anything related to their personal and business relocation needs. But we also do that for people who are not our investors, people who just contact us and need help with stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you're actively looking at property in Japan, you should check out Akiya Mart. That's A-K-I-Y-A hyphen Mart, M-A-R-T, akiyamart.com. It's the Zillow of Japan, built for buyers who are actively hunting for a home in Japan and want a much more Western-style web browsing experience than the typical local Japanese websites. Now, we've got an exclusive 30% off promo code for the Akiya Mart Pro annual plan. That's the one that gives you full access to Airbnb zoning maps, hazard maps, sold data, and over 500,000 listings nationwide at any given time. So if you're serious about buying in Japan and you want an easier way to search, this is the best tool that we know of. So you can use my code ZIV, Z-I-V, at checkout and get 30% off your Akiya Mart Pro annual plan at akiyamart.com.
Mm-hmm. So you have all of these different services going on. So how do you usually find your customers? Like, what is your marketing program like?
In the first few years, my marketing program was basically me. We never paid for advertising. We sponsored a few events. We're probably not going to be doing much of that as well. Kind of my concept has always been like, you know, if you want people to come to your party, instead of you going to a cool party, why don't you host the party yourself, right? So we set up our own channels, and then from those channels, as those channels, we then go and participate in discussions in other forums and groups. And then our, you know, if the information that we shared is valuable enough, then people will click on our profile and find us, right? We write articles that then get, either we approach various publications and ask them if they'd like to publish that article, or they would contact us asking if they can reshare the article. I mean, if they're respected, I don't mind people sharing it without asking me, but some of them will ask and give credit for it as well. And we've got the Japan Real Estate Podcast, which I was surprised when we started was not in existence. So we're the only source that I'm aware of steady, reliable, consistent information in audio format in Japanese. So that goes out to Amazon, Spotify, Apple Store, wherever podcasts can be found. That's usually done for us. These days, it's not me, or at least not just me. We've got a couple of marketing people who provide content as well, the social media guy and the client inquiries lady. So they do most of the work. I still share stuff when it's something that I've done, like an interview like this. I'll be sharing it first, and then they'll propagate it elsewhere. That's where the customers come from.
Right. Just to let you know, you were actually one of the influences for me to start my own podcast.
That's very flattering. Yeah. Really? Oh, thank you. I mean,
there was a podcast about podcasts.
Than mine, Matt.
Now, this is a true story. There was somebody did a podcast about podcasts in Japan.
Okay.
And you were one of the ones that was mentioned.
Right.
So I did some research and I said, hey, you know, it would make sense for me to do something. So
that's very kind of you.
Thank you very much.
The second person who told me that, and them like yourself are also like, the production value is something else. I just record my Zoom calls, or, you know, if I'm somewhere, I point a camera at myself. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, how can I take things to the next level?
I wish I had the time to deal with that.
You know, It's important to properly invest, you know, and
absolutely
something that
I agree.
You know, you're putting out there as marketing for yourself and your company. So,
mm. yeah. I think the reason I don't invest that much in production value, to be perfectly honest, aside from, you know, eventually I bought myself a professional microphone because one of our customers who is a listener of the podcast is just like, stop, take this. Mm-hmm. So I do have a microphone now. But aside from that, I find that if I focus on production value, my production quantity goes way down, right? Now I am able to release on average at least one or two episodes a week. If I was to level up, unless, of course, we outsource all of that, I would not be able to get anywhere near that frequency. So I prefer to focus on the content, like the value of the content. And you know, I'm obviously not much of an entertainer or an internet celebrity, but I only talk about stuff that I know. So people do tend to find value in the information that we share. And I just want to get as many of them out there as well. Record, post. My editing skills are extremely limited.
That's what it's all about, is it's getting the information out there.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's just move on then. This is something that I wanted to ask you because it affects your business and it affects my business, is the immigration policy in Japan recently. They're getting stricter with visas and things and qualifying for
now
visas.
Let's see how that works out.
Yeah. Well, you know, how do you think it's going to work out? Because is this, you know, do you think this is something we should be taking seriously? I mean,
we've had since I got more focused on Japan and moved here. So what, 14 years now, we've had a few spaces in time where I thought Japan's really going to pick up the immigration gauntlet and do something positive about it, right? Because we're the poster child for shrinking population and shrinking workforce, not to even mention the fact that half of the Japanese workforce, namely women, are not being utilized whatsoever. Even if they want to, they can't. That doesn't really bode well for Japan's economy, which again is a poster child of debt to GDP ratio as well, right? So there were a few points there, once with Abe and once later with one of his subsequent replacements, where I thought, oh, the way they're doing the talk, maybe they're going to do the walk in a minute. But then they shuffled the deck again with this new government. And then immediately after that, with this new immigration, which is immigration policy, which is we're supposed to finally get the details on in a couple of weeks, I think. I don't know to tell you. I know that, again, there's this huge gap between official policy, official opinion, government saying we need startups, we need investors, we need creative entrepreneurial thinking, we need to grow our population. But in practice, they're either not doing anything about it or doing the opposite. I'm hoping this is just another one of those dips, but I don't know. I definitely know that if they don't do something about it in 20 years' time or so, there's going to be some serious issues. I'm obviously no sociologist, but you can't cater to a shrinking workforce without bringing more people in, and those people get old and they need money that you just don't have. Japan's pension funds have not been doing a super, super good work in planning for the future as well. They're very concerned,
especially for maintaining the population.
Yes,
because
although I heard a few years back that they were investing in Canadian cannabis farms, which I thought was quite entertaining for a country that's as strict about cannabis as Japan is. But that was the only creative thing I ever heard about those pension funds doing, unfortunately.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Japan should start to get more creative.
Yeah, I mean, I love the country and I completely understand their fear of changing their character. It's very understandable, but there's fear and then there's reality. I think what Japan should really be afraid of is not how its character might change with immigration, but more about what's going to happen if there is no immigration to Japan. Because unless we somehow convince women to have more children, which I have no idea why they would do with no career. I mean, if their entire future is limited to staying at home and taking care of kids, why would you have more than a single or no children at all, right? I completely understand. But unless this or that changes, the future is pretty bleak. I know that for elderly folks, it's not a big concern. And, you know, the more elderly folks we get, the worse that's going to be. But if you do think about your children and your grandchildren and not just selfishly about yourself because you're dying in a few years, so who cares? I just don't want to see a foreigner on the street and I'm going to be dead, so I don't care about the future. If people who do have children and grandchildren start thinking a little bit about what might happen in 20, 30 years' time, I'm hoping there'll be some shift, but I don't know.
What about your future?
Personally?
Yeah.
I tend to plan, like financially, I plan ahead. Like I put seeds in place that will hopefully grow. And, you know, I try to look to the future in that regard. On a personal life level, I don't know, maybe it's the fact that I've been divorced once, widowed once, and these were both very life-changing events. Moved to Australia, moved to Japan. I try not to plan more than a year or two ahead personally. I know that anything might happen at any point in time. You meet new people, you get new ideas, people change over time. My son will move out of the house, hopefully at some stage, and then there'll be all these other options open, right? I don't know. I'm planning to enjoy it.
You're based in Fukuoka now.
Yep.
Do you think you're going to stay there for a long time? And can you tell us a little bit about the attractiveness of Fukuoka?
Yeah, I think if I'm living, as long as I'm living in Japan, I will, again, I don't want to, no guarantee, but I think I will stay in Fukuoka. It's the best city that I've ever lived in, personally. I think only Tel Aviv in Israel, which is not where I grew up, but it's where I, you know, I spent most of my years in Israel, is the only contender, and it doesn't even come close from the aspects of stability and safety.
Fukuoka. Sorry to interrupt, but what makes it Fukuoka so attractive?
A lot of things. So firstly, it's a family-oriented city or with family in mind. So we've got 80 kilometers of beach going east and west of the center of the city. Parks, bicycle paths, lots of outdoor activities aimed at families. Everything is around the city. I mean, it's a big city. It's 1.7 million people. It's, you know, it's not a small city, but the center of it is compact enough that you can get, you know how in Tokyo somebody says there's like this beautiful event or gallery opening or a show or a concert, whatever, and then everybody gets on the train and goes somewhere for like 2 hours and then 2 hours to come back. Fukuoka anywhere is accessible within a 20-minute bike ride, right? So that makes it very, very convenient for people. It's also got amazing food. The mayor's done a really good job at moving all of the heavier industries and sort of manufacturing and whatnot out of the city to other cities in the prefecture, so that Fukuoka now has this white-collar professional services startup capital-ish kind of vibe to it. I mean, as far as foreign startups are concerned, they've still got a fair way to go, but their heart's in the right place at least. It's just a pleasant place to live in. I was surprised because in Fukuoka, by the way, I can just tap my debit card when I go in and out of the subway. That's not a thing in Tokyo still, is it?
No, you can't tap it.
Okay. So, like stuff like that, right? Like we're kind of modern. I don't know.
It seems to be a very forward thinking city.
Mm. At least since the current Japan. Mayor came in power, yeah.
But it's not a humongous city, is it? No.
About the size of Las Vegas, I guess, for your American listeners. Yeah. 1.7 million people ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not so big in Japan.
No, not huge. No.
But everybody is on about Osaka these days, and Osaka is the next Tokyo, they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I like Osaka. It grows on me the more I go there. I like it.
Yeah. But as the new capital of Japan, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit far-fetched, right?
Tokyo, I don't think there's any contenders for Tokyo in that. I don't see Tokyo losing the crown, barring some that major earthquake that they keep, you know, they keep warning us about. Maybe that's going to change things. But aside from anything drastic like that, I don't see. Tokyo is unique, not just in Japan. Tokyo is unique worldwide.
Yeah. Tokyo is a monster.
Yeah.
Like Godzilla.
Yeah, for better and worse, right? Yeah. I love coming here, but I don't know that I would be able to live here much longer than these periods that I come here for.
It's a growing monster.
Is it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, Fukuoka is it's not a big city, but it's the biggest city in Western Japan. So the added attraction there is Southeast Asians coming to Fukuoka. It's actually a lot closer to fly to Taiwan, Korea, some parts of China than it is to Tokyo. There are a lot of people these days who don't even get to Kyoto, Osaka, Tokyo. They just do a Kyushu holiday, mm-hmm. or Kyushu Shikoku holiday, mm-hmm. and then fly back to Singapore or whatever, right?
The Kyushu circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ziv, thank you very much for coming on today.
Pleasure. Yeah. This was fun.
Your advice today is very valuable. So it's great to have somebody with deep knowledge like you come on. So I really appreciate it.
That's very flattering. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. See you again soon.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Jeremy Lovelin of Momentum Worldwide Movers. Definitely keep them in mind if you're relocating or thinking about relocating your family or your company staffers into or out of Japan. We'll link to their website as well in the episode show notes. Jeremy will probably also be attending the summit in April, so feel free to drop by, grab him for a chat if you'd like to talk shipping into and out of the country. And again, the early bird discounted tickets will only be available for another 3 days, right up until the 28th of February. But they'll still be available for purchase at the normal price, which is also quite low, at least until they run out, which doesn't look like it's going to take too long this time around. We've started selling them a lot earlier than previous events. So that's it, really. Looking forward to seeing you all there with us in person or via the streaming room, 18th, 19th April in Tokyo. Now, we can't let you go without telling you all about Yen Loans, our latest sponsor. They're a new non-bank lender offering financing to non-residents of Japan for purchases of Tokyo condominiums, soon to be expanding to other major cities as well. So definitely hit them up if you're looking to purchase in Osaka, Fukuoka, Kyoto, or any other big city too. And that's for any purpose, whether it's a holiday home, investment rental, or a combination of both, without any requirement for residency, a Japanese bank account, a Japanese corporate structure, or representative director, any of these things, and with a streamlined application process too. So reach out to them through the link in our show notes and let them know that you found them on the Japan Real Estate Podcast. And if you're quick enough to be one of the first 10 completed applications, you'll receive a 25% discount. That's 50,000 yen off the 200,000 yen application fee. To qualify, apply through the link in our show notes again, or enter the code JREYL on their website, yenloans.com. And that's it from us for this episode, folks. Huge thank you for tuning in. Please do follow and subscribe to the show if this is your first time listening, and we'd love it if you could like and even share this episode with anyone you think might find interest in it. But even more importantly, we love hearing from you. So please let us know what you thought about this episode or the podcast overall in the comments section here on our social media channels. We've got a very active Facebook group and business page, both under the name Japan Real Estate on Facebook. And that's also the name and URL of our YouTube channel if you'd like to follow us there, Japan Real Estate on YouTube as well. And we'd, of course, appreciate your rating or review on Spotify or on the Apple Store or wherever you're tuning in from. Hope to have you with us again. Have a great rest of the day or night ahead. よろしく。